Today is the third lecture in the series of six, Britain since the Romans. And I have put on the blog, you have the address of the blog, I have put on the blog a recording of last week's because I know sometimes I talk a little fast and it can be a little difficult. And today I'm going to be looking then at the high and late Middle Ages. We have the early Middle Ages, then the high Middle Ages, I don't know why, and then the late Middle Ages. And so 1066 to 1485. Why 1066? Because 1066 is the invasion of Britain by the Normans. Why 1485? Because 1485 is the beginning of the Reformation. You say in French, la réforme, the Reformation is the invention of Protestantism, and the Reformation is the moment when England is no longer a Catholic country, but becomes a Protestant country, which makes a big difference. In particular, if you remember that in the past, in this period, religion and politics are the same thing. I will explain more about that later. It's a difficult idea. So, Britain since the Romans, the high and late Middle Ages. We have in English the plural, the Middle Ages. En France, vous dites le Moyen Âge. And there is, of course, no exact date for the Middle Ages. Nobody said, oh my God, the Middle Ages is going to begin this afternoon. It's a very general idea, which is after the Roman Empire and before the Renaissance. The Renaissance is the moment when classical knowledge, Plato, Aristotle, etc., becomes popular again. In the Middle Ages, people are not really interested in Plato and Aristotle and so on, because the most important thing is the church. So, let's see where we are. William the Conqueror, Guillaume le Conquérant, donc, invades Britain in 1066. And the first question is, why does he win? Why is he successful? His army is not very big. It's a small invasion. 6,000 soldiers. 6,000 soldiers. It's not a lot of soldiers. It's not like a modern war. Armies are very small. So, why did William win? William arrived in Britain with only 6,000 soldiers. And the reason he won is that his soldiers had better technology. Better technology, in particular, better archers. Yeah, better constructions. Also, he was lucky. It's also important to remember that many of his soldiers were professionals. They were fighting for money. They were not fighting because they loved Normandy and the conquest of Britain. They were fighting for money. The problem of soldiers who are fighting for money is that if they are losing, they sometimes join the other side, which is very intelligent, but not very easy if you are a king. So, when the successfully take over Britain, fundamentally what William does is he declares that all the land belongs to the king, and he gives the land to his friends. Yeah. If you are a king and you want to stay king, you need friends. And so he introduced a new Norman idea. The Norman idea is all the land belongs to the king. And he can lend it to you. He can not give it. You can have the land if you fight for me, etc. The second thing he did was to make sure that the English accepted. 6,000 soldiers, so not a big invasion, and there were several rebellions. One of the biggest rebellions was led by a gentleman called Hereward the Wake. Herod was the leader of one of the biggest rebellions against William. They particularly had problems in the north of England. And this was followed by an event which is known by historians as the harrying of the north. Littéralement, le harcèlement du nord de l'Angleterre que William aurait fait. Now, harrying is a very nice term. Plutôt génocide, il faut penser. Hein? So this was very much, let us arrive, destroy the villages, kill the people, kill the animals. Very violent and vicious massacre. Now, the Normans were quite advanced from a technological point of view. Please. Hmm. Yeah, I have a little technical problem here. The whole thing is blocked. Ah, there you go. Oh, so there's William. There's William the Conqueror in the Bayeux tapestry. Now, the Bayeux tapestry, c'est une tapisserie, donc en fait, et s'il se trouve à Bayeux, c'est pour ça qu'il s'appelle le Bayeux tapestry. And it is made at this time, and it tells the story of the invasion of Britain. Yeah, il réagit, mais très lentement, c'est ça, hein? Wonderful technology. So, as I was saying, the Normans are very advanced in technology, and in particular in architecture. And one of the things which they built, which was particularly impressive, was the Tower of London. A whole section of the Tower of London was built in 1067, and you will see it in a moment. The they were also able to build cathedrals, which we'll also see in a moment. There's William the Conqueror. Ah, the Tower of London, built by the Normans when they arrived, and still standing today, still in good shape. Another very important thing which William did was to have the Doomsday Book written around 1085. Now, the Doomsday Book, what is it? It's a catalogue of Britain in order to help the king to collect taxes. So it's not very interesting to read. Here you have the name of a village, how many people live here, how many animals do they have, how much tax do they pay. That's not very interesting for you, but historians are very happy, because normally we don't have this information. If you look at Italy in 1085, we know very, very little. But in England, there's this book with all the details. So that's really very good. And at this time, we know that one quarter of the land in England is the property of only 11 men. Only 11 men. They own a quarter of the whole of England. And these 11 men, none of them speak English. They all speak French. And in fact, for 100 years or 200 years, the elite will speak French and the people will speak English. That will be the situation. So, what was it like to be king at the time? It's not the same as today. Today, if you are queen, you have your private jet and so on. What is the situation of the king at this time? The first thing is the king must move all the time. If the king stays in London, after a while, there is a rebellion. He must always move. Because of course, he can't. He doesn't have a Twitter account, so he can't contact people. He must physically move and arrive every year here, 2 months here, 2 months. Keep moving around to make friends. You've got to have friends if you want to stay king. This is this is very complicated because, of course, when you arrive in a new town, supposing the king wants to go to York, he cannot phone the local Carrefour and ask for food. Yeah? They have to organize, and so he sends a messenger. The king is coming in 2 months' time with 500 people. You must feed us. Now, feeding 500 people is difficult today, but at the time you need hunting, fishing, taxes, so an enormous organization. And every year, the king gives three big parties. He doesn't call them parties. He gives three big feasts where he invites all his friends and everybody eats a lot. And this is the time when he gets the information, who is loyal, who wants to be rebellious. So the king is always very, very frightened of revolts. This is a time when, if you are king, suddenly you find, oh, my brother has killed me because he wants to be king. This is fairly normal, yeah? So it's a tremendously unstable situation as king. Secondly, the church is extremely powerful. The king is in alliance with the church, so the king talks to the Pope. Hello, is that the Pope? Telephone. He said, I recommend this person to be Archbishop of England. What do you think? And the Pope said, oh, yes, okay. Yeah, so they're working together. But sometimes there is a conflict between the king and the Pope. And in this case, sometimes the Pope says, okay, everybody in England is excommunicated. Tout le monde en Angleterre est excommunié. And this is something which people take very seriously. People are very worried about this. So you have the king's power and the church's power, which generally work together, but not always. Now, when the king goes away, because the king sometimes goes to France to fight in different wars, and he will leave the kingdom in the power of, you know, you are my trusted servant. You can look after England while I am away at war. And sometimes it's very dangerous to go away, because, of course, there could be a revolt when you're not there if you're a king. And indeed, in 1308, famously, King Edward left his lover in charge of King Edward. King Edward had a lover who was a man, and he left his gay lover in charge of the kingdom while he went away to war. And the aristocracy were not very happy with this idea. They didn't like this idea. 1308. The doomsday, coming back to the doomsday book, lot of information here. For example, one village, let me give you one example, one village, the village of Dunwich, le nom n'est pas important, un village, was one of the biggest ports, a lot of fishing, and every year this village had to pay tax, and the tax was 68,000 herrings. C'est quoi l'impôt cette année? About 68,000 herrings. And this is very symbolic because at this time, money is not the most important thing because there are not many shops. So money is not so useful. And so the people don't have money, and so they pay tax in very complicated ways. This village must pay 68,000 herrings. This village must pay 200 dogs every year, specially trained dogs. Yeah. And so a very, very complicated situation, a very complicated kind of economy. The other thing we know from the Doomsday Book is interesting that if you have the whole list of towns and villages in this book, is almost exactly the same as the list of towns and villages today in Britain. That is to say that every village has already been founded. All the best land is already occupied. Even though there are parts of England which are still forests and marshes, des marais, most of the best land is already taken. At this time, the Doomsday Book, there are still slaves in Brittany. Il y a encore l'esclavage en Angleterre. What is the percentage of slaves in Britain at this time? 10%. 10% of the population is slaves. This is important information because it means that the slaves are not the center of the economy. 10% is not enough to be the center of the economy. The center of the economy is serfs, c'est le servage, où on doit travailler sur la terre du Seigneur, et en retour, on a un petit bout, un petit lopin de terre pour soi. So that's what we know about it. Now, little by little, the marshes and the forests are disappearing. This book also calculates the taxes, and calculating taxes at this time was very difficult. And I don't know if you would have been very good as a medieval accountant. Let's see. Can you just do this multiplication for me? Multiplied by... Yeah, you can see the problem. Unfortunately for the English at this time, they have not yet learned from the Arabs the Arabic system. The Arabic system is much better. Much better. This is murder. Terrible. For multiplying, it's absolutely terrible. And of course, they have another problem, because today, if I want to do a calculation, I simply get out my iPhone and I do my calculation. Of course, at this time, they don't have any iPhones. And what they do have is the abacus. On dit en français souvent le boulier chinois. Je ne sais pas si c'est vraiment chinois. But you can see what I mean, an abacus with 10 balls here. And experts can do it very, very quickly. And this is the center at the time. So, I mentioned a little bit about the king. That's also the Doomsday Book again. I mentioned a little bit about the king. Let's look at the king's servants. The king has a lot of servants. If you look at their salary, it's very interesting. So, for example, if you are my servant, my chancellor, you calculate everything for me. Your wages every day are 5 shillings, 1 best quality loaf of bread and 2 ordinary loaves of bread, 1 jug of best wine and 1 jug of ordinary wine, 1 candle, une bougie, and 40 candle ends, 40 bouts de chandelle, littéralement des bouts de chandelle. Now, the reason for this is the money is not so useful to you. There are not many shops. And candles, on the other hand, when there's no electricity, in the winter, candles are very, very valuable indeed. But you can see that the economy is very complicated. Your wages are very complicated. Oh yes, how many bread and wine and candles and so on. So very strange for us today. And this is typical of medieval society. Money is not the center. Land is the most important thing to have. La terre, il faut avoir de la terre pour être riche, pas de l'argent. That's not the most important thing. And very traditional. The king had a lot of servants. We have a servant to dry the king's clothes. Your job is to dry the king's clothes, that's all. Okay? And you don't have any machines, of course. We have another. You can be my servant. You have to organize the king's bath every month. Yeah, that's not a joke. Il y avait un serviteur qui devait organiser tous les mois le bain du roi. Because, of course, the concept of being clean is not the same. Many people had to hunt for the king. Hunting. Rabbits, deer, very, very important. And the interesting thing is that rich people ate a lot, but rich people did not eat well. They ate meat, no vegetables. Now, today we know this is a very bad idea. But at the time, this was very, very common. But it was difficult to know because many people died anyway. People died of all sorts of things. There was no sugar. Honey, le miel. Il n'y avait pas de sucre, donc il y avait le miel. Very, very important, of course. Now, the Norman system, the Norman domination of England, was fairly stable. But they had some problems with Wales. Ils avaient des problèmes avec le Pays de Galles. And little by little... Sorry, will you stay with us, please? Thank you. Little by little, there were wars, conflicts between the English kings and Wales, avec le Pays de Galles. And here I have some buildings which will show this. This is a photograph today, but this is a photograph of a castle which was built in 1283 by the Norman kings. Now, I don't know if you can see, this is a big old-fashioned castle with the windows. The windows, the narrow windows for firing arrows from. And if you want to attack this castle, it's not easy. Bon, maintenant c'est un peu plus facile, c'est un peu délabré. Not easy, and the people at the top will pour hot water on your head. Not so good. Now, the most important thing about this castle is that this castle is not built by people who feel secure. If you say, oh, there is no danger, everything is stable, you don't need a castle like this. This is a castle built by people who are still paranoid. We won against the Welsh, but they might attack soon. And this is what you can see. And very good castles, they are still there today. So, yeah, they're very well-built castles. Here's another one, Rhuddlan. Built in 1277. This is my favourite one. The walls are extremely thick. The walls are like this, yeah. Rhuddlan again. Carmarthen. So, these castles show that the stability was not so stable. They were still very frightened of attack. The Normans also built incredible cathedrals. York Minster is a cathedral in York, as its name shows, which was built, begun in 1080, and I think it took 100 years to build. Many of the cathedrals took a long time to build, and this is an enormous thing. And I think I have an outside view as well. Yes, there it is. So you can imagine, even today, this would be an impressive building. With the technology of the time, this is very impressive. And one of the reasons for the cathedral is to be impressive. The farmer comes from the village to York every year. And they look at the cathedral and think, wow, the church is powerful. I'm not going to revolt. Yeah. Je ne sais pas si quelqu'un a vu la cathédrale à Albi, en France. Ça a été construit après une révolte cathare dans le sud pour convaincre les gens d'être loyaux. Et vous arrivez, vous le regardez, finalement, ils ont peut-être raison. It's really very intimidating. So, the aim of the cathedrals is to intimidate people, but also to impress them in other ways. Inside the cathedral, there is the most advanced technology of the time. When you go into a cathedral, you see a clock, an horloge. This is extremely impressive technology at the time. Nobody has a clock. How do people know the time? Somebody, yeah, that's right. The ringing of the church bell. The man in the church looks at the sun. And says, oh, the sun is there. It must be 3 o'clock. I'll ring the bell. So the clock is extremely impressive. Number two, the organ, l'orgue de la cathédrale. Very impressive technology at the time. And those are the most important thing. The troisième grande innovation technologique de l'époque, c'est le moulin à vent, qui n'est pas dans la cathédrale, celui-là. Okay, so trying to impress, of course, that the church is extremely powerful and they must impress and intimidate and help people. If you want to be very powerful, you must impress and intimidate and help. All three of them. Pour ceux qui veulent dominer la société, je l'ai. Salisbury Cathedral begun in 1220. That's the inside of Salisbury Cathedral. This one is in Germany, but it's my favourite cathedral, so I wanted to show you this Cologne Cathedral. And there's the clock. Even today, these are very nice clocks, but at the time, wow, it tells you what time it is. That's just incredible. Just incredible technology. Here you have something very, very interesting. This is in a town called St. Albans. It's a modern picture, but this is a very, very old clock. This is a clock from 1403. And it is very impressive because it's not in a church. And at this time, a clock not in a church was very rare, and it shows that at this time there was a conflict between the church and the town bourgeois, and they said, okay, we're going to build our clock, we don't need your church clock. So it's a sign of conflict. Okay, let's go back to the political history of Norman England. So can you stay with us, please? Thank you. There were still some revolts. For example, in 1169, there were revolts in Yorkshire and in Cheshire. And the aristocracy begins to become unhappy with the absolute power of the king. And in 1215, King John was obliged to accept to sign a document which limited the king's power. And this document is known as the Magna Carta. You can still see the document today. There are a few copies of it in London, in the British Library. This is a very early example, almost, of a written constitution. Remember, yes?
Which is the king that signed it?
King John. Yeah, me. Yeah, King John, it was me. Okay, I'm very old. The document, it's very difficult to read, yeah? Very difficult to read. And this document is very influential because it is the first document in the world which explains the right to trial by jury. C'est le premier document qui dit que ceux qui sont accusés, parmi les aristocrates au moins, ont le droit à avoir un tribunal avec des jurés. The first time. So it's a new idea. And also, it says that if you are arrested and put in prison, they must give you a reason. And some extracts from this document are used again in the American Revolution and at the French Revolution. So this is an early idea. Now, King John signed it. Can you stay with us, please? Thank you. King John signed it, but he was not going to follow it. He signed it. His fingers crossed. His fingers crossed behind his back, and he was signing it. And this led to a civil war. There was a civil war, the first barons' war. On appelle ça la première guerre des barons, des nobles, quoi. The king was obliged to make some concessions, and he agreed. He said, every year I will organize a meeting of aristocrats and bishops to give me advice. And this is the parliament. Now, of course, it's not democracy. It's the very beginning of parliament, is a regular meeting of aristocrats and bishops in order to advise the king. So he agreed to take advice. Notice the situation. The parliament is not the boss. The king is the boss. But the king accepts to meet the aristocrats and the bishops every year. Do you have any good ideas for me?
That's the situation.
So let's look below the king at the aristocrats. We have the barons and the knights, this is very much a society where among the elite you have to fight. If you're an aristocrat, you have to fight. You must fight. With a sword, of course. The aristocrats are French. That's also the Magna Carta. The aristocrats are French. This is a knight of the time. And this is the time when they introduce into England all this kind of stuff. These symbolic, les blasons, the symbolic heraldry. This is a French idea which is introduced into England at this time. And now the English, I think, do more than the French. You know, the Queen has a thingy and so on. So if you're a knight, you are obliged to fight for the king. But sometimes the king will say to a lord, if your son doesn't want to fight, give me some money instead. So very slowly, the obligatory military service of the aristocrats reduces very slowly, and the money they must pay increases. We have a very slow movement towards a money economy, very slow. Now, what did the knights love to do? They loved to have tournaments, des tournois. They loved this. This was great. This was a great thing. And of course, you know, you fight and you hope that the lady will give you her, I don't know, whatever the lady is supposed to give you. These could be very long. Sometimes there were 2,000 people in a tournament. And many people were killed in these games. Now, it's not as violent as the gladiators, where dozens of people were always killed, but people did get killed in these. The fighting became more sophisticated. The armor became much heavier, and so on. At this time in the economy, the forests are very importantly for hay. The forests are changing. The wolves are disappearing. Les loups disparaissent. The wild boar, le sanglier, disparaît à cette époque en Angleterre. But the forests are very, very useful for ordinary people. Most people are poor, and they need the forest to get wood to burn, to keep them warm. And also, of course, in the forest you can find rabbits, animals to eat. But the forest belong to the king, and the ordinary people are not allowed to go in there. So if you're a peasant and you go and shoot a deer and you're going home to eat it with your family, you better not get caught, because if you are caught, you are executed. You are killed if you steal a deer. So remember, this is still a very, very, yeah, very, very heavy sort of place. There are many popular songs from the time about, yeah, I am going to die because I stole a deer from the king's forest. Technology is getting better at this time, but the technology of agriculture still has a long way to go. For example, today, if you live from a farm, you plant some plants in the summer and some plants in the winter. Notamment, vous ne savez pas parce que vous êtes comme moi, vous n'êtes pas des fermiers, turnips and swedes, c'est-à-dire le navet et le rutabaga, on peut les récolter en hiver. C'est ça ce qui est important. They didn't have these at the time. They only had vegetables for the summer. And this is very bad because it means that in October, November, you must kill all your animals. Because you have no way of feeding the animals in the winter. Yeah? Because you can't grow the winter things. Now, of course, you don't kill all your animals. No, you keep at least one male and one female for next year. Yeah, but so these are things which make life very difficult. The technology, the science about vegetables is not as advanced as it was before. And this is a society before writing. Almost everybody cannot read and write. And if you have a book, the book has been copied by hand. So before the invention of printing, avant l'invention de l'imprimerie, technology advances very, very slowly. Because technology can only advance if you have a book. Yeah. Oh, what's the best way to do agriculture? I better find a book. Now, at this time, what's the best way to do agriculture? I'll go and ask the oldest man in the village. Yeah. Not a good idea, yes? Can you imagine? Instead of looking on Google, say, oh, bon, j'ai pas Google, je vais aller demander à la personne la plus vieille que je connais. Ça va marcher des fois, et des fois déjà moins bien. Yeah? Okay, so problems of the advancing of technology. Nevertheless, food is getting a little better, and we can tell this because of the rise. Silence. Excuse-moi, mademoiselle, si vous voulez repartir, il n'y a pas de problème. At the time the population is rising, so for example in the 11th century we have probably 2 million people, and in the 14th century 5 million. Now today this is not so impressive because today we expect population to rise, but before this the population of England went like this, yeah? It didn't go like this, it went like this. And so this is a relatively successful advance in agriculture and technology. Now, life was nevertheless extremely difficult. For example, the doctors were really not very good. It was like magic, forms of magic. You know, oh, you're feeling very ill. Let me take some of your blood. Do you feel better? Ah, no, I probably didn't take enough blood. Yeah, it can be pretty shaky. This begins to change in the 12th century when you begin to get translations of Greek medicine.
Alors, c'est une histoire très intéressante. Les Grecs, ils savaient certaines choses sur la médecine qui ont été perdues en Europe, mais traduites en arabe. Parce que à cette époque, la civilisation en Afrique du Nord était beaucoup plus avancée.
And in the 12th century, in England and in Europe, they begin to translate from Arabic the famous books, the Greek books about medicine. So that's one of the things I wanted to mention. Okay, so life is very, very hard. Life expectancy, you have a little baby, a new little baby. Life expectancy, 31 years. Yeah? On average, the baby will probably die when he's 31. Okay, now, of course, the most dangerous part of life is when you're a baby. If you get to 10 years old, then you have escaped the most dangerous diseases. If you get to 10 years old, life expectancy, espérance de vie, 42. And if you get to 30 years old, life expectancy is 52. So, what is dangerous? Of course, illness is very dangerous, les maladies. But also, hunting is dangerous. Work when you are building a cathedral, it's dangerous, yeah, the safety. But the most dangerous activity, more dangerous than war, more dangerous than manual labor, more dangerous than hunting, what is the most dangerous activity? Anybody? Yeah? Yeah?
Giving birth?
Yes, exactly. Giving birth, accouchement. More dangerous, yeah, very, very, absolutely, extremely dangerous, yeah. Remember, you have 15 children, 10 of them die, and you die after in number 15. Yeah, extremely dangerous thing for the time. Now we're now moving towards the end of this period, and I just want to talk about the 14th century, le 14e siècle, the 14th century. Okay, there you go. There you get your situation. The first thing to say about the 14th century is the Black Death. The Black Death or La Peste. Now, the Black Death came back every now and then. There are many epidemics of the Black Death, but the biggest one was in 1348. And here you have a picture. It's not a photograph. Here you have a picture of somebody, two people in bed. You can see that they are not feeling very well. Yeah, they have the plague, of course, and they're not looking in a good way. And who is this? Yeah, saying it. Yeah, it's a magician. Yeah, a magician. Do you think that the magician will help? Not so sure, huh? Not so sure. Yeah. Yes. C'est un magicien. At this time, magic is tremendously important. And in any case, the Black Death of 1348 was the biggest of the plagues. In Europe, 25 million people died. Yeah. 25 million. More than the First World War. Yeah. 25 million people died. We don't know exactly, but approximately 30% of the population of Europe. This is 30%. You died, you're alive, you're alive, you died, you're alive, you're alive, you died, you're alive, you're alive, you died, you're alive, you're alive. Yeah, you get the picture, yeah. Sorry. Okay, you died. Okay, and in Britain also. Now, when you have 30% of the population that dies, this makes a big difference to the whole of society. First of all, there were not enough workers on the farms. Not enough workers. 30% of them died. And when there are not enough workers, the wages, the salaries, rise. It's normal, yeah? Yeah. Give me more money. No. Okay, I'm going somewhere else then. Okay. Yeah. It's not very complicated. And this led to the very first case in history where the government, the king, intervened to control wages. And so in 1351,
The king released the statute of laborers. And the statute of laborers, very, very simple idea. The king says salaries, wages, the money which you pay people to work on your farm must not be higher than before the plague. Yeah. So the king declares everywhere in the country, if your salary is higher than it was before the plague, it must be reduced. It is illegal to pay more than the salaries before the plague. And it's probably the first time that the king intervenes on wages. It is not very successful. I'm a farmer, I need workers. It's illegal to pay them more. But on the other hand, I need workers. Yeah. So the law is not so effective as is often the case. Also at this time, many of the farmers were not allowed to leave their village. You're a farmer in this village, you have your lord, you're not allowed to leave, you're a serf, you're not allowed to leave. But many people did leave. Oh, there's more money in the other village, okay. But then if they're arrested and come back, say, well, we can execute him, but we don't have enough workers. If we execute workers, things are going to get worse. The other important events of the end of the 14th century is the Peasants' Revolt of 1381. Sorry. The 1381 Peasants' Revolt, La Révolte des Paysans. And this led to the fame of the leader Wat Tyler. Wat Tyler was one of the leaders of the peasant revolts. And he is today, like Robin Hood or Spartacus, a popular hero in Britain. So what happened in 1381? Well, the king decided to raise the taxes. And in particular, he decided that it would be the same tax for everybody. You're poor, 10 shillings. You're rich, 10 shillings. And the poor people not so happy with this idea of the same tax for everybody. It's what they called the poll tax. Poll tax has another meaning in America and another meaning in modern Britain. But here this was the poll tax. And the revolt began when one village refused to pay. The tax collector arrived in the village and said, I have come for the money from the tax. And the people said, throw him in the river. Yeah, this is the way they did things at the time. And it was a very impressive revolt, yes?
So could you stress the shot when you write on the board?
Oh, you can't read it, can you not? Yes. Yeah. 1381. The rebels came together and they walked to London. From all of Kent and Essex, they walked to London. They went into a prison and they released one of their heroes, John Ball. John Ball was one of their leaders. John Ball. No, actually, I have another idea. And they released him from prison. This is going to take a long time, isn't it? Went on to London, and they obliged the king to negotiate with them. They went to the Tower of London. In the Tower of London, they found the Archbishop of Canterbury, the leader of the church in England. They killed him. Now, this was a real revolt. This is the peasants' revolt. John Ball. And so this revolt, they obliged the king to negotiate, but when Wat Tyler went to negotiate with the king's soldiers killed him. Never trust a king. Yeah. Okay. So the revolt was not successful, which is not surprising, really, at the time. But it was an enormous revolt. People from many, many villages came to London, killed the Archbishop of Canterbury, and tried to force the king to change this tax. But this revolt, the peasants' revolt, shows something else, because one of the leaders was John Ball. And John Ball was a priest. And this is important because at this time, religion was so important that if you wanted to change society, you always spoke about it in a religious way. Let me explain this. It's very important. In the 14th century, if I say, I want a different society, the king says, no, this society is perfect. This society is exactly how God wants it. God has decided I am king, and so this is the society which is correct for God. And so the people revolting are obliged to say, we want a different religion. If you want a different society, you want a different religion. And so the people, the peasants' revolt, they said, no, you are not telling the truth about God. We know what God wants. So a social conflict is also a religious conflict. And I will repeat several times, for hundreds of years, religion and politics are the same thing. Because everybody believes in God. Everybody believes that God has a particular idea of what kind of society they want. And so every political conflict must be a religious conflict. Let me give you an example from John Ball. Here is a famous quotation from John Ball, which I'm going to explain to you. When Adam Dalf and Eva Span, what was then the gentleman? Okay, don't conogli moderna. When Adam delved and Eve spun, who was then the gentleman? Ou en français, quand Adam creusait la terre, donc au début de l'humanité, et Eve tissait les vêtements, ils étaient où les aristos? So you can see that this is a very radical idea, because the revolts are saying, you are the king. You say that this society is what God wanted. Let's look in the Bible. And remember, everybody believes the Bible is true. Here we have Adam and Eve. I don't see any aristocracy. Yeah? The aristocracy, we don't want them. Yeah? And so this is a very radical religious point of view. Radical religion terrified the elites. And at this time we had a radical religious group called the Lollards. The Lollards are a religious group. And what they say is, what they do is they translate the Bible into English. The Bible at this time is in Latin, and they translate the Bible into English. This doesn't sound very radical today, but at the time this is revolutionary. Because the Bible in Latin, who can read the Bible in Latin? The priests. So, if you want to know what God wants, you must ask the priest. The priest is the expert who owns the Bible. If the Bible is in English, of course, most people cannot read, but in every village there is somebody who can read. If the Bible is in English, a lot of people can have an opinion about God's will. So translating the Bible into English is a tremendous radical idea, which says everybody should decide. We don't want the church to be so powerful. And the reaction of this is very, very strong. And indeed, the people who translated the Bible were often executed. Si vous traduisez la Bible en anglais, assez souvent, on vous brûle pour décourager les autres, vous voyez. C'est sûr que si on brûlait les gens pour traduire, je traduirais moins. So that is the Lollards. And here we have, in fact, this is a picture of Wycliffe. Wycliffe is one of the translators. Very last piece of information for today, the Canterbury Tales. 1386, 1386, l'écriture d'un livre de fiction, une des plus influentes, The Canterbury Tales, which is an amusing and sarcastic picture of society. And he describes a group of people who are all different members of society, and they are having a competition to tell stories to each other. For example, there is a prioress, une bonne sœur, une mère de couvent, mais ce qu'elle aime surtout, c'est séduire les garçons. En principe, c'est bien. So he's very sarcastic, but it's very indirect. And there is a monk, a moine, également très critiqué. A friar there was, a wanton and a merry. In all the orders four is none that can equal his gossip and his fair langage. He had arranged full many a mariage of women young, and this at his own cost. Je vous traduis. Il y avait un moine et personne n'était aussi fort que lui en commérage et en beau parler. Et il avait d'ailleurs organisé le mariage de beaucoup de jeunes filles, hein, et il a insisté pour tout payer de sa poche. Alors, vous êtes censé comprendre pourquoi ce moine payait de sa poche le mariage de plein de jeunes femmes. Hein? Et donc c'est très indirect, mais c'est what it says in the Canterbury Tales is a lot of the church is corrupt. A lot of the monks are mostly interested in sex and not in religion. A very, very strong criticism of the church. And this criticism of the church will be tremendously important in the next period of history that we will be looking at next week. Because the power, so the church will be criticized for corruption. For example, one of the things the church did at the time was, I don't know if you remember, how many people had a Catholic education? Qui a eu une éducation catholique ici? Moi? Oh, bon, on est de moins en moins chaque année. Voilà, les trois. Super. OK. Protestants? Encore quelques-uns? Musulmans? Juifs? Athées? Je m'en foutiste. Okay, well, let me explain to you something about Catholics. Remember, for Protestants, there is heaven and hell. For Catholics, there is heaven, purgatory, and hell. So, in theory, if you're a Catholic, if you die, it depends. If you're very bad, you go to hell. If you're very good, you go to heaven. And if you're kind of in between, you have maybe 20 years in hell, in purgatory. Or 100 years in purgatory. Now, at the time, the Catholic Church would sell documents. I have a document here. If you give me 1,000 euros, I will give you this document, which is a reduction of 10 years from purgatory. Il veut pas. Mais à l'époque, ça marchait. Okay? So this kind of... And of course, this idea is not in the Bible, not at all. This is a way of making money for priests, and they did this a lot. These were called indulgences, indulgences. On vendait des documents, des indulgences pour réduire le temps au purgatoire. I will be explaining more about the criticism of the church and the rise of Protestantism next week. Thank you for listening.